This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Raslan, today we have BFM's very own Uma Pagan, Ampike Pagan.
Hello, Cam.
Hello, Uma. And we have the return of writer, filmmaker, and actor, Naa Murad.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Our three topics this week will be, topic number one is the modern hero. Topic number two is storytelling, education. And finally, topic number three will be guns.
So can't be any more different.
Here we go. Maybe it's all the same. So with topic number one, Uma, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the superhero movie genre.
Maybe a little bit.
Yeah. Superhero. Yeah. What is that?
Okay. Well, let's see if you can keep up. I watched a movie recently called Black Panther.
Black Panther.
I'm sure you've
heard of it. I think.
Okay. It's quite popular. And I was watching it, and the thing that I really struck me was the hero. The hero. His name is T'Challa, which I also believe is a condominium somewhere in Damansara.
Most likely.
No, that's T'Challa. T'Challa.
Okay. With a D.
T'Chaka and T'Challa.
Oh, okay.
The Wakanda apartments.
And I was watching that and I was thinking the hero is a very strange character in this because he is, unless he has his, unless he drinks the magic potion, which gives him great strength. Unless he drinks that, he does not in himself have great strength.
His name is Obelix?
Clearly, exactly.
I think so. And the villain in the piece,
right,
physically is stronger than the hero by quite a long shot. The villain is also more, in a way, his struggle is actually in a strange way more heroic. He's dedicated his life coming from nothing.
He's also more charismatic.
He's more charismatic. I think that may also be the actor.
True.
He's more American.
He's American. Yeah, he is American. The hero, as it were, on the other hand, is African, as imagined by Americans. And he's surrounded by these strong women.
Yes.
Who pretty much save the day.
Who do everything.
And in a way, his superpower, the hero's superpower, really is just being a nice guy.
And he is. He's a good guy with a good heart.
Yeah.
That may not be enough to be a good
king. That's a great line. Right, that's a great line. The king says, you're a good man. It's difficult for a good man to be a king.
Yeah.
And I think it's all about that. It's all about, you know, what you have to compromise in order to be a leader.
Which is why I think it was such a different superhero movie. And I think, you know, we brought this up a few weeks ago, Cam, when we were talking about Thor. And you said, you know, all superhero movies, you were worried that they were all going down the same path of world-saving nonsense.
Yeah, plot-wise, yeah.
And plot-wise, right? And I think that's why this one kind of stood out, because it was so different. And part of it had to do with the fact that, and I mentioned this in my review of the film, that he didn't feel like a superhero. He felt like a conflicted world leader. His character, he felt like one part James Bond and one part conflicted world leader. There was very little of that Tony Stark swagger or that, you know, Captain America moral righteousness. I mean, even in this film...
First couple of acts of Hamlet.
Exactly. Hamlet. Yeah. First couple of acts of Hamlet. But also even in this film, the moral, righteous, ethical dilemma, it's all a bit grey, isn't it? Mm. And I think that's why I liked it so much, because there were so many narratives to pick from.
But did you like the hero?
I did. I liked him as that conflicted world leader. And so I don't know if you're both of you, any of you are familiar with the comic books. I mean, in the comic books, that trope kind of runs through, in the sense that, yes, he has these enhanced strength and he goes around fighting the Ku Klux Klan and all these people as well. But the weight of the throne is something that is constantly apparent.
Hmm. I did notice something about the comics. I can't tell you which writer, which period, because I'm not that big of a comic geek. But he did, not anymore. I'm out of touch. I'm a comic geek who's out of touch.
Okay.
But he seemed more hard ass. Is that? I mean, he would do something that you would see borderline Clint Eastwood kind of thing, which didn't happen in the movies. He was a very nice guy.
Tapi 2018. You know, got to be a bit sensitive. Like, you can't be Clint Eastwood anymore.
But not straight away, right?
Not straight away.
Movie number three. Maybe then,
well, yeah. let's look at heroes. Let's jump back a bit. Now, for a start, Black Panther is a black character. It's not often that you get a black hero anyway, so maybe the dynamics are going to be different.
He was one of the first, I mean, in the comic book world as well.
Yeah. Yes. But let's jump back, say, to Star Wars. In the original Star Wars, George Lucas had immersed himself in the works of Joseph Campbell, who spent his life studying heroic myths to find the core story. And so if you look at, say, Han Solo, I think he is the hero. Is he not? He's a hero, not necessarily the hero, but he's a hero.
Yeah,
and he exhibits that outsider. It's a popular trope: the outsider who wants his independence,
right?
Who is
in it for himself?
In it for himself. I mean, eventually he discovers a moral core and he comes and saves the day.
Wasn't Luke the classical Joseph Campbell hero?
Yes.
You know, the guy who has to leave home. He has to grow, learn something, make mistakes, and then come back and redeem himself.
Has a sense of idealism about the world.
Goes all the way back to Jesus, apparently, according to Joseph Campbell, right? He has to leave and then, you know, he comes back and he saves the day and walks on water and stuff.
Yeah, you know, goes to India for a few years and hides out there, yeah. Apparently.
Well, if he's the hero, if Luke's the hero, then that's the same.
That's a classical journey.
But that's the same as King T'Challa, is it not? Is it the same?
A little
bit. Same as Hamlet as well.
Actually, it's a little bit the same with every single superhero, right? I mean, they all have that. If you look at the first Iron Man movie, just keeping it within that Marvel scenario, it's the same thing. He is a cocky, arrogant arms dealer. He goes to Iraq. He gets blown up. He learns the error of his ways, goes on this journey, comes back a changed man, and then rises to become that hero that we deserve
Doctor
and need. Doctor Strange.
But then everyone. But very quickly, though, we don't have much time, but very quickly, I want to jump then back here to Malaysia and the Malay hero. I mean, you too, especially you, Umar, actually. You've watched a lot of hero movies recently.
Thanks.
What is the Malay hero?
The Malay hero whinges when he gets criticism on the net.
Jangan kecam. That's the Malay hero. No. Okay, so here's the thing. I think a lot of the Malay hero tropes kind of track back, and I'm sure people have written studies about this. I don't know. This is just my belief. Kind of track back to the Tuah Jebat scenario. In that you pick a side as to who you think the hero is. And I think a lot of our stories, much like Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, a lot of our stories track back to that loyalty to authority, loyalty to the king versus loyalty to friends. And it seems to be a trope that plays out in a lot of movies, right?
Which is ultimately, I think, perhaps why Black Panther is so popular here, because that's a Tuang Jebat. What did I say? Tuang.
Very much a Tuang Jebat storyline.
Yeah, Killmonger is the rebel.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's the hero. I think we've solved that one.
Job done, sealed, signed, delivered.
Next.
Oh man, mine is so serious compared to that.
Yeah, so storytelling.
Okay, well, storytelling. Preamble here. I was teaching at the MMU Film School when he had moved to Johor, and I had some success. And the dean said, well, partly your success is because, you know, you followed this ratio of education, which is 80% performance and only 20% information. And I was quite surprised. I thought, like, well, isn't it about the information?
Nas said, no. There, like, I was dropping gold. What do you mean it was only 20%?
Great information. But then I understood that, you know, like, a lot of times education is storytelling. And it got me thinking, you know, over the years. And from watching documentaries about the Khoisan people of the Southern Kalahari and South Africa, that when you look at them and the way they pass information, you can imagine that all our ancestors, they were practically represented, all our ancestors, but our early ancestors, wherever it was, you know, Tunbridge Wells, Malaysia and India. Back in the old days, in Tunbridge Wells. Yeah, but it was just the bridge.
I was referring to where I grew up, actually.
That our ancestors told teaching. Back then, it was like there was a lot of imitation of animals, imitation of how people did things,
right.
Sounds, and it became a storytelling element. And it affected the arts, I think, in general. I can't say for sure about art as in drawing in caves, whether that was done just for the pure fun of it. But can you imagine, like, the moment somebody decided to imitate a bird? It's the time when the normal usage of sound that humans would to that point started to experiment with imitation, and then you could say that is the beginning of singing and music. I mean, that then it grows and it becomes an art form, but also a form of teaching. And so I just kind of, you know, would like to talk about the fact that I believe that it comes hand in hand. A lot of people say a film has to be informative, but I think that all storytelling and a lot of arts came from just this need to teach, but in a way which, once we created language, teaching became, something which made us successful, basically, as a species and as an animal. We could pass any kind of information down. And so, you know, I don't know if any of you have anything to say.
Oh, no. I totally agree with you. And I think it extends to almost every field. Like, you were a better teacher because you were a good performer. And I think the same works for doctors. I think the doctor's job may have a certain more percentage of information involved, but I think you go to see you go to see a doctor and you enjoy a doctor because part of it is slightly performative when they're looking after you. That we call it bedside manner, right? But it goes a long way to actually healing a patient. I think if you have a terrible doctor with terrible bedside manner, it's the same with lawyers. It's performance in court, right?
It's true. I have a mechanic who makes what's wrong with your car sounds like something so fascinating,
right?
and this is what I'm going to do.
And it's what we do here every day. I mean, half the time, whenever you're on live radio, for example, it is a performance. It is not you. I mean, this is not Cam Ruslan. This is Cam Ruslan of a bit of culture.
Mm.
And it's a different person, right? Because you're performing.
He's incredibly boring in real life.
He's got 20% knowledge and 80% performance in real life.
Well, speaking of which, I do want to ask, perhaps what the man was actually saying to you was there was actually 20% coherency and 80% fart jokes. You know? And that is why I'm only going to pay you 20%.
No, but it's a great thing, right? The whole idea of without that performance, no matter how much information you have, it's not going to register with me.
It's not.
But the thing is, I think that most of us are exposed in our lives to watching a single person. When we watch a single person perform, as it were, live, is in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And in that situation, the audience, the students, are not allowed to leave. They're a captive audience. They cannot switch channels either. And so the expectation is that they're going to sit there and they are going to absorb this information, and it doesn't matter how it is put over because they're basically prisoners. But in most of the rest of your lives, when you experience anything, you always have an option. I mean, you're listening to this right now out there in Radioland, folks, and you can
switch off
at any moment. Obviously, you're not going to because this is so incredibly interesting. And I think that we carry that over and we ourselves, whenever we speak to people, we assume that we are lecturers, and that's a captive audience, the person we're talking to. PowerPoint presentations, so boring. And yet,
because it's not storytelling.
It's not.
It's just points.
The people you're presenting to are stuck there.
Mm-hmm.
So if their bodies are still in the room, even if their minds have gone somewhere else, you're still a success.
Like Cam. Cam and I are both fans of Max Hastings.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
The historian.
The historian, especially World War II. You read some of his... he wrote, what was it? All Hell Breaks Loose, or the one about World War II, in one volume.
Right.
And you think it'll be too much information. It'll be very boring. It'll be just, you know, basically. But he makes it, feel like you're watching a Netflix 12-part miniseries because you are there. You are so immersed. He immerses you into the drama of it.
It's that ability to convey complex information in an entertaining manner, right? Tuckman does it as well.
Barbara.
Barbara Tuckman.
My favorite historian.
Your favorite historian does it as well. And I look at other... I'm a huge fan of Bertrand Russell. I guess in philosophical circles, people don't necessarily think very highly of him. But if you want to understand philosophy as a layperson, you read his stuff because it is so digestible. Richard Feynman, one of the greatest physicists in the world, was also a great physicist because if you read any of his work, he takes some of the most complex notions in physics and talks to you like a human being. And I think the ability...
Stephen Jay Gould.
Exactly. But the ability to do that is very important because I think he understands it better than everyone. That's why he can take all of that information and kind of just wrap it up into a little bow for you, even if you know nothing at all, and just go, this is what it means, and you're like, oh. I think it takes genius to be able to do that.
Oh, okay. Before we depart from this, have you and I ever had the good fortune of having a teacher like Anna Amurad who can inspire us in that way?
I've had a bunch of particularly English teachers throughout my years in primary school and in high school who've been particularly fantastic and entertaining, who've gone beyond the, this is your comprehension passage, now answer five questions. Yeah. You know,
or just stood there and just wrote on the blackboard for 45 minutes and then left.
Correct. You know, they would perform the stuff that they were reading, and they'd get into the pieces of literature or excerpts that they made you read. And I've had a handful of teachers who are really, really good in that way.
Nah, you?
Not until I reached college. I had nice teachers. I had nice teachers in primary and secondary, but they didn't make what they were teaching particularly interesting. I mean, they didn't depart from just the facts, but they were nice people. So
You see, I had a French teacher who was really entertaining, great fun, and yet I still didn't learn a damn thing. So maybe that's
much fun, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. So we're going to move on now. And in a moment, we come to topic number three, which is guns, here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Uma Parkin, Amke Parkin, and Naam Murad on A Bit of Culture, I should say. And finally, topic number three, Uma, guns.
Guns, or bang. The gun. Of course, we don't live in a bubble, and so we've been following everything that's been going on in the United States after another mass shooting, and one of the worst in recent history.
17th or 18th in this year.
In this year alone, right? In the last 2 months, at a Florida school, right? And this has caused an intense debate, bigger than usual, because the kids are getting involved now. And these high school students who were involved in the shooting are taking on, you know, the NRA and the government and Donald Trump and all of that stuff. But all that politics and stuff aside, it goes back to this idea of fascination with guns. Now, on a base level, the Americans chalk it up to the Second Amendment, which kind of enshrines their right to bear arms, right?
Apparently.
And the pioneer history period,
Correct. And the Founding Fathers probably had a different understanding of that, in that they wanted to prevent people from being oppressed by a king and therefore give them the right to overthrow oppressive governments, not carry around submachine guns to 7-Elevens. But anyway, it got me thinking about not just American fascination with guns, because they can blame their constitution, but all of our fascination with guns. And I can't just blame America and pop culture for it, because I think it runs a little deeper in that kids running around playing cops and robbers, going bang, 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 and all of that stuff. And sure, it may be influenced from what you see on TV or movies, but why does the gun fantasy fill us with so much comfort? And why do people keep making those films? So we see it in Malaysian films, we see it in Thai films, in Korean films. It's a global phenomenon, and I don't think it's just an export from Hollywood. I don't think we've just seen Hollywood movies and want to emulate it. I think there is something about this notion of a good man with a gun, or a good woman with a gun, that can somehow change the world and make it better.
Yeah.
It's a revenge fantasy, but at the same time, it's like, this is what happens when the good guys get it, not just the bad guys. And it's appealing, right?
Well, I mean, you say when the good guys get it, in a way, in America, it's very easy to buy a gun.
Yes, and almost too easy.
And just about every other country, it's incredibly difficult.
Correct.
So, for instance, in Korea, I've been watching a lot of Korean movies recently. And so a lot of the times when they go off and they need to show people killing each other, the instinct in a Hollywood movie would be get the guns out and start firing. Instead, with Korean ones, they bring out axes.
Nice.
And they start chopping each other up. Right. So on rare occasions, though, guns do come out. Yeah, the guns can be fired by police on one side and the baddies on the other, but often not. And when society has broken down so much that in somewhere like Korea, where people can get your hands on a gun, they're all bad guys. I mean, it's terrifying. I remember watching British movies where you can't get a gun in Britain. Mm-hmm. When they bring the guns out, I mean, Get Carter, Michael Caine's magnificent Get Carter,
yep,
set up in the Northeast where there are no guns, and they bring out guns, they start firing, and it's like, oh my God, society is completely broken.
Collapsed, right?
All of these people are on the wrong side of civilization.
There's that great line in Guy Ritchie's Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels where someone whips out a massive knife and he's like, guns are for show, man. If you really want to F them up, use a knife. You know? Yeah. And, you know, but
Guy Ritchie's a schoolboy.
But when you talk about the fascination, it's quite interesting, because in Japan, they have one of the strictest gun rules.
I think they do.
People can't even hunt until they've you know, I don't know what the requirement is. But they have this fascination for guns where they have these model guns.
That's right.
That people collect, which can't be shot. I mean, it's been the barrel has been filled up with something or whatever, right? Can't be used. But there's still this fetish. This gun is such a cool thing. It's like this destructive toy. In your fantasy, it can solve all your problems. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe because the bad guys always have guns these days.
And that's where a lot of these movies are rooted, right? In the sense that the good guy is usually a guy who's, you know, never touched a gun or doesn't want guns, but, you know, he's got no other recourse. The police are not helping him. And so maybe I need to become like the bad guys, or maybe I need to take their tools and use it against them. I mean, that's that logic that flows through so much fiction.
If it's a superhero film, then it's the superpowers that makes him superior. But if you can't have superpowers...
And you're immediately bulletproof, right?
Exactly.
That's the big thing.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're wearing body armor or you're like Superman, I mean, even created 75 years ago, Superman, what was it? The primary thing was, even before he could fly,
bullets bounce
bulletproof.
Off him.
Bulletproof.
Yeah. If we jump back a bit, though, quite a bit, in fact, I've been reading a lot over the years about the 19th century, and I came across many passages written by Britishers around the world in the colonies, and they would write about hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd read another passage by a different person writing about his hunting experience, be it in Ceylon or Malaya or Africa, and I found that they were all the same story, essentially. And one of the things that they were writing about was how they, as Europeans, as British people, had this technology called the gun that the natives did not have, and that they had the ability to work the gun. And that they had the courage to be able to stand down an elephant or a tiger to the right moment.
Because
when
it's
you
such
shoot
a destructive
gun.
Force, right?
No, but also you can't just shoot willy-nilly at a tiger. You've got to get it at the right moment. And then in all their passages, they'd write about how when the native got their hands on the guns, they were scaredy cats. They would fire it in the air and run away. But the gun, what they were doing with the gun was clearing the land of tigers and crocodiles and making it fit for civilization. And that was their USP as white people.
Right.
Is it also safe to say that this is a very, very guy fascination? In that there is very little fiction out there in which women glorify guns as well. We have a couple of movies by Quentin Tarantino, and there's some classic blaxploitation movies
so maybe
as well.
Catherine Bigelow.
And Catherine Bigelow.
Made by women.
But not just made by women, but the chicks genre. With guns thing. But the chicks with guns it's thing also men. Feels like it's for men because they're wearing bikinis and shooting AR-17s. Maybe it's something that has to do with men and our penchant for destruction, maybe. I don't know.
I don't think women are immune to it, though.
I don't think they are.
I mean, you know, Pride and Prejudice and zombies.
True, but I think that's still for the guys. It's, you know, like
no,
hot
I don't know.
Chicks with samurai swords.
No,
but women like
but
those
not,
kind
not,
of films.
You know, not Elizabeth Bennet in a Regency-style dress.
Okay, well, Wonder Woman was one obvious version which women took to. But what's the difference?
But it had nothing to do with guns, right? I think it's very interesting. It's very interesting, actually. In that last Wonder Woman movie, there was a very conscious effort by the filmmakers to show you that she's constantly defending people throughout the film.
And herself,
And herself. It is not necessarily an aggressive action.
Except for leaping at that church tower and blowing it up.
Except maybe for that.
I've been reading on Twitter, and you do come across a lot of these American women who do themselves fetishize guns.
Right, in America, mostly.
And they really do put, you know, so much of their personality, their sense of self, is based on their ability to own and operate a gun.
So what you're saying is we can blame the Americans for everything, lah.
Well, no, it's just as an experiment.
Bay, his fault.
No, but as an experiment, a global experiment, we have the good fortune of having a country where anybody can have a gun.
Yes.
And so we can see under the microscope what happens when you do that.
Mm. Actually, just one last thing before we go. Now you were saying before we stepped in here, you mentioned something about the gadgetry of guns.
Right. A few years ago, I read a bunch of opinion pieces about, you know, the whole gun problem in America. And somebody said, gun has this geeky tech value to it. It's like it's like how we loved cameras in the old days when you can take things apart, and how people just like ethics and things like that. There's a gadget kind of draw to it, a gadget fetish to it. It's this beautiful, slick metal thing, which is, tell you the truth, the gun is a wonderful piece of
engineering. Right? Oh, it's magnificent. Yeah.
It's totally unpowered. It does not have batteries or anything. It just works like clockwork. And it is clockwork in a sense.
Well, before we move on, though, have any of us three actually fired guns?
I have not.
I have, actually. Yeah, my father had a handgun. Mm-hmm. And his whole family was into hunting. So at 15, he thought, oh, time to make the boy a man. So off I went into the paddy fields up in
he hunted you.
He chased you through the paddy fields.
Dodge the bullets, boy. No, but yeah, he got me to fire a gun at living things, which, you know, I was totally hopeless at, but, you know, at least I had experience. And he had his handgun at home, which I found fascinating. I would sneak it out and play with it and learn to take it apart. I actually could, well, not blindfolded, but I actually could take that gun apart and put it back together.
You're not deer hunter. I mean, come on.
I briefly had an air rifle, and that was fun, to, you know, point at a rabbit and then at the last minute point it 1 foot above. Because I didn't actually want to deal with a dead animal. What do I do next?
No, but a friend of mine whose father was a war hero, they all grew up with guns because his father could keep guns at the house because he was a war hero. When you start playing with guns, right, even if it's innocuous, you're shooting at cans, there is a point where you get this curiosity of wanting to shoot at something that is alive. You do, and you fight against it. But he said, you do. You end up and you see a monitor lizard, and then you go, it's just a monitor lizard. And that's where you start. You shoot one thing, and it becomes this weird fascination. I can't attest to that because I didn't hit anything in that one hunting trip. But there could be that fascination once you start playing with guns. Okay. Because that's its purpose. It's its purpose.
Well, we should do that then. One day we'll set up a bit of culture where we
go to a gun range.
Yeah, we hunt the ultimate prey, human, and then have a chat about it afterwards. Perhaps producer Ali could arrange that. So now, though, we move on to the final part of the show. Recommendations. We recommend something that we think might be of interest. And so I go first.
Yes.
Now, I want to recommend... Well, the thing is, right, I mean, my cultural experience of the last week is, well, I'd like to recommend a brand new sitcom called Friends.
Sounds good, Cam.
Only 2 decades old.
Yeah. I've been watching it a lot, and it's so good. And then I've also been interspersing that with another brand new sitcom called Frasier, which is also from the 90s, and it's also incredibly good.
Throw in Cheers, then, why don't you?
I was so keen on Cheers.
Really?
I like Cheers, but I just felt that Frasier was really... Anyway, I can't recommend
the
that.
Guy who played Frasier's dad just died.
So yeah, that's right. That's a good recommendation. Right. But yeah.
Oh, okay. No, I was going to recommend something a bit more hoity-toity and a bit more kind of like high culture, but I won't. What I'm going to recommend is because John Mahoney, I think his name is.
John Mahoney, yes.
Who was the father on Frasier, just died. Therefore, it's a good excuse for me to recommend a brand new sitcom called Frasier. I've been watching so much of it. I love it so. I love it when something is kind of perfection, where everything is just... You watch all these other sitcoms, which is, 25-minute long moments where you would have thought enough people are involved that they could make it work. And then so many sitcoms are bad. So when they come together beautifully, it's a work of art.
And sitcoms are very formulaic. When, you know, we've done a lot of work on sitcoms. I've done even more than you. And I had to argue with certain directors and producers that look at Frasier. It's like there are only 3 scenes. 3 acts sometimes. It would be like a one big scene in the beginning, middle, end. And you know, because people are insisting it has to have 16 scenes and you have to have this many laughs per minute. And, you know,
and Frasier was the same. Every episode was the same, but the writing was so cunning that you looked past it. I mean, Niles would always almost find himself in the same scenario every week. And so would Frasier. Nothing would ever go right for him. And yet, the writing was so sharp, the quips were so good, the plot was almost irrelevant.
Yeah. There's a lot of what they call business.
yes.
Which is just sort of like pointless stuff on the side. And it works so well. So, yeah. So, my recommendation is Friends and Frasier. Very lame. So,
mine is lame, too, because I realized that the thing that I wanted to recommend, I already did. So, yeah. Okay. Now, I'm going to blame Uma for talking about... No,
thanks.
You didn't talk about superheroes. You did. You talked about a hero. Okay. So, all these superhero films, right? You know, you've got a Shakespearean one. You've got a science fiction and teenagers and stuff like that. I recommend quite an old film, I think from about 5-6 years ago, called Super by James Gunn.
Yes.
James Gunn, before he did
Guardians of the Galaxy.
He wasn't even famous yet. And this is It's funny, but it's a totally down-to-earth, realistic superhero film. It's about basically a guy who's a loser who just goes crazy and he wants to be a superhero. He has absolutely no superpowers. His assistant, played by that woman from Juno, I can't remember her name, she's also has no powers except they're both insane. You know, you see somebody double parking, they'll smash up his car with a monkey wrench, that kind of crazy stuff. But it's actually quite dark and very, very interesting. Hmm. The other side of what a superhero would be like if there should be superheroes in real life. If people should just wake up one morning, decide they want to put on a weird costume and go and fight crime. It's called Super. By James Gunn.
I've never heard of it. Sounds great.
2010,
it's a very, very good film. Yes. Yeah. So. And that was where Disney kind of discovered him and gave him Guardians.
From that, right?
Yes,
from
that. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, correct.
All right, check that out. Super.
Just Super. Right. Yeah.
Actually, we have a bit of culture connection with the movie Super.
Right.
One of our guests on A Bit of Culture, Aidil Rusli, he's in a band called Couple, and one of their songs is featured in the movie, in the soundtrack.
Another reason to watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uma.
I'm going to recommend a movie that's currently in cinemas. It's been nominated for a whole bunch of Oscars, but the reason why I'm recommending it is because I've been spending a lot of time thinking about our upcoming general election. It's called Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And
my favorite 2017 film.
Is that your
film.
Favorite 2017 film? It yeah, it's right up there with me. It's between that and Shape of Water for me. Mm. But the reason why is, you know, there's all this rhetoric going on with our upcoming election. And this movie kind of speaks to everything we're going through, even though it's set in Missouri in the United States, which couldn't be further disconnected from where we are. But it is about, one, it is about proactive action. It is about subversive protest. And it also is about a bunch of characters, all of whom are flawed. Everyone's a mess and everyone is completely and utterly unreasonable. Frances McDormand's mom, yes, she's had a terrific, terrific loss, right? But she is completely unreasonable. The sheriff is unreasonable. The racist cop, Dixon, played by Sam Rockwell, is unreasonable, racist, tortures black people. I mean, but yet, they're all incredibly human. Mm. And I couldn't think, it's so funny, watching this movie, it's so disconnected from where we are, and I just couldn't help thinking about Malaysia. I was just watching that, I was like, oh my God, that is everything we're going through right now, right? All of the arguments we're having are taking place in this film on a much smaller scale, which has to do with the rape and murder of a girl and a crime not being solved. And yet everyone, no one's good, no one's bad, everyone's unreasonable, everyone's kind
they're
of harassed.
Suffering.
They're all suffering.
Of something
also,
or other.
They're all angry.
You're all angry.
And that's that line in that film, right? Anger just begets more anger. Hmm. And yeah, I mean, like, you want to watch a movie? Like, it's the most left of center election movie I can think of, but it's really weird.
And you're never going to be able to predict what any of the characters are going to do next.
And what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's actually more fun than you thought it would be.
Oh, it's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funnier than you think.
Yeah. But that's the other sad thing, right? That's the other thing. We just look back at even our situation. We can't do anything but laugh. So, it's great. And also, and I said this in my review of the film as well, there is no writer-director like Martin McDonagh who uses curse words in the way he does. I love him. Nobody curses better than him.
Well, I was going to mention him, actually, because he's British.
He is.
And I don't suppose when he cooked up this idea, he'd ever been to Missouri.
Probably not.
No. And so he created some kind of like abstract moral tale and then probably threw a dart at a map, hit Missouri, and just said, I'll set it there.
Yeah. Works as well as any small American town.
And it's great because his films usually have these very big and strange and eccentric criminal type characters, the seven psychopaths
In
Bruges. But this is about regular people. It's his first film that's about very, very normal, I'm doing air quotes, people.
Yeah, it's definitely his best film. I think so. I didn't like In Bruges at all. It was just
Did you not? I loved In Bruges.
Yeah, it was just like cliche character.
Yeah, but that's the thing.
It was sub-Tarantino.
The Tarantino-ish
thing. Let's stop trying to pretend to be Tarantino.
Yeah,
you
know, okay. I'll stop.
Do you understand? Do you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
All right, stop it, Morad. So,
Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Yes, please watch it.
It's good.
It's currently showing in Malaysian cinemas, and it's not butchered. Hardly anything's been censored. Language.
They've censored. They just faded out now, right?
They don't even cut. So.
All right, so that's Three Billboards in Ebbing County. I'm looking forward to seeing what he does next.
I am too.
Yeah.
Mm, definitely.
So that brings us to the end of this week's show. Only remains me now to thank special honored guest, Na'amurad.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Uma Pagan Upke Pagan.
Pleasure, always.
He's rarely here, right?
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah. And he's not too bad on radio. He's a bit shy at first.
I'm like a ghost.
And myself, Cam Ruslan. That's a bit of culture. Join us next week for another exciting episode on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.